Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Policing, Incarceration, and Reform. My name is Jeff Lamson, and today we'll be talking with Dr. Emily Brooks about her new book, Gotham's War Within a War, Policing and the Birth of Law and Order Liberalism in World War II-era New York City, which is now out with the University of North Carolina Press. Dr. Brooks is a historian and full-time curriculum writer at the New York Public Library Center for Educators and Schools. Her work has previously been published with the Journal of Urban History, Washington Post, the Journal of Policy History, among other places. And she's held fellowships from Mellon, ACLS, and New York Public Library's New York Public Library Center for Research in the Humanities. Dr. Brooks, welcome to New Book Network.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
My pleasure. So we always begin by asking if you would tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to studying the history of policing, as well as the origin story of this book in particular and your focus on New York City.
Yeah, thank you. So I would say even before I went to graduate school for a PhD in history, I was interested in criminal justice reform. I worked at an organization that was involved in drug policy reform. And so those kinds of issues and questions about mass incarceration, about racist and racialized policing, questions about the role of the punitive state in American life at home and around the world, all of these were questions that I was interested in exploring when I started graduate school. And I began kind of reading and researching on those themes and was really interested in a lot of work that was coming out about women's experiences of policing and criminalization in the kind of post-Reconstruction to early 20th century North in urban areas. And as somebody who has always lived in cities, I've been interested in urban history since before I really kind of understood that as a subfield. So I started kind of exploring those themes and found that a lot of that work ended in the beginning of the 1930s. And then there was also a lot of kind of exciting work that was coming out about the rise of mass incarceration and how we can kind of understand that. And so I was interested in exploring kind of what was happening in the intermedium area in the years in between that kind of early period where there was an explosion of research and the later years. And I was in graduate school in New York City and, you know, kind of saw I experienced and saw all around me the impact of police on urban life and came to understand the sort of role of the NYPD in municipal police departments across the country. And so I started kind of being interested in researching on those themes. And then while I was in graduate school, I also taught a lot at different CUNY schools, including community colleges, which I also feel like kind of broadened my research focus, allowed me to think about things in different ways and really enrich the way that I was thinking about engaging with history. And so I finished my PhD in 2019, and since then was kind of working on putting this book proposal and the book together. So here I am.
So it's actually a really great segue into one of the questions that I have, because you mentioned sort of your experience reading about the history of policing and the temporality of it, that a lot of it took place leading up to 1930 and then sort of toward what some, you know, the punitive turn or around the 1960s or so. And another way to think about that is breaking it up as pre-war and post-war, but your book is very much about New York City and policing there during World War II. And so can you talk a little bit about that particular sort of time frame as being really important, what it meant for the nation to be at war as it was impacting policing?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started doing that research, I was so surprised to see how much language and concern and energy was devoted to perceptions of crime and criminality in the city during the war. And so how there was this, the kind of language, both the metaphor of war in talking about crime and policing at home. So, you know, the title of the book comes from a letter from a magistrate to Mayor LaGuardia saying, we have a war within a war against juvenile delinquency at home. And then they're always talking about a war on prostitution. The way that the war really invigorated these concerns about dynamics, behaviors, and what I argue in the book, kind of groups of people who before the war were seen as kind of problems of urban order. During the war, they are sort of reframed as problems of national security. And it's both because, you know, the war is like, it's a massively destabilizing and changing moment in all these elements of American life. So you have, you know, a huge percentage of the civilian population is moving during the war, as, you know, many historians have looked at and talked about. You know, men are being drafted, women are moving into manufacturing in new and varied ways, depending on where they live and who they are. But so there's all of this concern that these changes are going to kind of produce new forms of criminality, like for juvenile delinquency, the idea that nobody's at home. And so kids are just kind of out on the streets doing what they will. But it also produces these, you know, new opportunities for changing social dynamics that are very concerning to the city's administrators, to the kind of law enforcement entities, both in the city and nationwide. So there's anxiety that men are interacting with women, that there's going to be white men who are going to be going out and meeting Black women, meeting Puerto Rican women, that there's going to be interracial socializing and potentially sexual activity, that women are taking on new responsibilities. They're out on the streets in new ways, and that's problematic. So some of the new kind of attention to law enforcement and policing during the war is about these like moments of social change and energy and flux. And you also have, of course, mass mobilization and energy to call out the hypocrisy of requiring Black Americans to serve for in the military in a war that's being labeled as a war for democracy at the same time that they don't have full democratic citizenship rights at home and are discriminated against in the workplace and in many other arenas. But so there's like part of it is about these new dynamics and sort of stemming those tides. But then there's also what I saw, and part of the reason that my book is not just about the World War II years, but is about this whole period when LaGuardia and his police commissioner, Louis Valentine, are in office from 1934 to 1945, is that what I saw in New York, which was really interesting to me, is that they had actually been trying to push forward these kind of modes of policing since they came into office in the 1930s, this new intensified surveillance, this new criminalization or intensified criminalization of women, of young people, of Black New Yorkers, of Puerto Rican New Yorkers, all under the guise of saying kind of The police department is now going to be nonpartisan. It's not going to be corrupt. It's going to be aggressive and expansive and police the city with kind of new vigor. And that is going to be fair and equitable. But the way that the administrators, that the police commissioner directs the police officers to look for criminality is based on these ideas about race and gender and class. And so you see now that there's this new invigorated attention to policing people along those lines. But throughout the 1930s, it meets with varying degrees of success, and it's contested by different groups of people, particularly by groups led by Black women. But in the war years, those issues are reframed. Now any type of mass mobilization in the city could disrupt production. It could disrupt shipping lines going out of the city. And then there's also this intense concern about white enlisted men coming into the city on days off or before they're shipping out, and that they're going to meet women at nightclubs like the Savoy Ballroom and potentially contract venereal diseases. And that then is going to reduce what they called the man days that can be used to fight the war. And so what happens is during the war, these kind of projects and goals that had been important to LaGuardia and Valentine in the 1930s gain new momentum. They gain new political justifications, new support from networks with the military and with the city's health department and the Federal Social Protection Division. And it becomes harder for people to challenge them, quite frankly, because there's intense pressure to support the war mobilization and to contribute in kind of whatever ways that you can. And so you have, like I talk about in my chapter discussing gambling, it's like before the war, male gamblers were kind of targeted as like unproductive, shirkers, lazy. But during the war, you have neighbors, people writing in about their own neighbors saying, I saw so-and-so gambling on the street. Why is he not drafted? Or I think he has, he's using too many gas rations to get around. Does he have some kind of special dispensation for the war? Why is he not sacrificing in the same way that I am? So it changes a lot of these dynamics. And I think bolsters the punitive policing state at home.
So so much of that is about the politics of policing, right? And so you have this line in the book where you talk about policing is less a response to crime than, quote, an expression of political priorities of governing elites. And one of the things that I really loved about reading your book is that you make this point really clearly, that the impactful relationship that we need to study here is not the relationship between policing and crime, but the relationship between policing and politics. So can you talk a little bit more about that approach of seeing policing through politics? And here you might also emphasize the LaGuardia and Valentine as political actors in this moment, the way that they're using the police force in a way for a particular set of political priorities.
Yeah, so I feel like when I started writing this book, I thought I was writing a social history of policing during the war. And then when I finished, sort of through the writing process, I was like, oh, this is really a social and political history of policing throughout the 1930s and the 1940s. And it was kind of like the further along I got in the project, the more prominent the theme about politics became, because it just was so apparent to me the role that policing played in LaGuardia's kind of vision of what a reform government could mean in this moment, and how his vision of sort of government's responsibility to its citizens was reflected through the policing practices. And I think that that's something that people had up until now, some other historians as well are kind of revisiting this policing in this moment. But LaGuardia has been a very influential New York City mayor for many years. You know, the New York Times a couple months ago had an article about how he was the last popular mayor. And he, of course, had a national profile as well. He was a congressman beforehand. He was the head of the National Conference of Mayors for many years. And he had a kind of particular relationship with the federal government. And so his vision of kind of urban politics and liberal modes of governing American cities, I think, is really important. And it was so surprising to me when I was researching this, how I just found that like discussions about crime and policing were everywhere in his speeches, in his radio addresses, in his how he saw this as so important. And when I was doing the research for the book, I felt like I really understood why that was, because when you look at the kind of politics that preceded him, I think it's really important to see, understand how that shaped his vision, because, you know, he was a reform mayor. So he was reacting to what came before him. And so he had, before LaGuardia comes into office in 1934, we have this kind of mode of policing and city governance that is dominated, not exclusively, but predominantly by a faction of the Democratic Party called the Tammany Democrats. And it's a very kind of neighborhood-driven, network-based, ethnic-based mode of politics where what you can expect to receive from the city government is based on your your neighborhood relationship to the party in power and patronage practices. And we also have the way that the police department is working in this period is as a direct extension of the political party in power. And, you know, policing is still, I would argue, extremely political today. But the way that it functions changes really dramatically in the 1930s. And that's kind of what I'm looking at, what I wanted to argue in the book. And so, you know, when the first professional NYPD is formed, or this first professional police department in the city is formed, it's originally talked about as a jobs program. And that's kind of how it was thought of, right? It was a way to give jobs to low-level party members and then kind of steer people towards supporting the political party, enforce support at elections, demand payoffs, and assist different party members. It was, you know, crime was not this kind of central concern and the central way that the kind of responsibilities of the police department was thought of. But as, you know, many historians have looked at, this is a mode of politics that is in which corruption is a very integral part of how the system works. And so, you know, throughout the 1920s, this corruption and police violence, which is very intense during this period, both kind of combined to strengthen the opposition against Tammany. And in New York City, in New York State history, there's a kind of long historical thread in which the city was controlled by this faction of the Democratic Party, and the state more often was controlled by Republicans, although not always. And of course, there were efforts, reform and anti-corruption efforts within Tammany and sort of different power struggles, you know, throughout this history, but broad strokes. So at the end of the 1920s, there, as part of this kind of power struggle between Republicans at the state level and Democrats at the city level, you get this massive investigation into corruption in city politics, and in particularly the police department becomes a central focus of a lot of those investigations. And they're very heavily publicized. So it's front page of many of the city's newspapers regularly. And these practices become apparent to people about how, you know, members of the police department were regularly shaking people down. They were regularly framing women for sex work and then extorting them There was a sort of very well-organized network in which that happened, where there were, you know, that involved magistrates, police officers, bail bondsmen, undercover agents, et cetera. And so all of this comes, comes to light. And it's only because of that corruption investigation that this very powerful Democratic faction that had built this pretty significant neighborhood-based network throughout the city can be discredited enough that somebody like LaGuardia can win the mayor's election on this kind of fusion ticket that has some Republican support and some support from other anti-Tammany figures throughout the city. And so when LaGuardia comes into power, he is very much saying that he's going to shape the way that his government works in a different way, that it's not going to be like the Tammany system where you kind of get what you put in for, basically. And so he, you know, has this vision of city government where, and this is kind of where I interject the kind of liberal element of this political project, is this idea that there is going to be a kind of an urban citizenship in which people deserve access to state resources, not based on their partisan political connections to the party in power, but based on this idea of kind of rights and citizenship. And so, you know, people should have access to various public services and modes of public life because they are citizens of New York, basically. And he puts that into practice in a lot of different ways, and other historians have looked at some of these, you know, he was a big believer in a lot in New Deal programs and put into practice big public spending that changed the built landscape of the city, that created a number of different types of public jobs and new types of public arts programs, et cetera. But a really important part of how he thought about that mode of urban citizenship was in relation to the police department. And so he has this vision that, you know, no longer are you going to be able to escape punishment or any type of accountability or surveillance from the police based on your party allegiance or your ability to pay them off. Police are going to be nonpartisan, they're going to be professional, and they're going to enforce particularly vice or crimes of morality throughout the city, because both, as I said previously, you know, the kind of most high profile element of those investigations was about the way that policing for sex, crimes of sex work and other crimes of morality or vice was an opportunity for corruption. And that is because though in those violations or in those, you know, moments of criminality, the only person who is the witness about the supposed crime or violation is the police officer. They're the complainant. You know, it's not the same as a moment in which there's somebody, you know, has been assaulted or robbed or something, and there's a person who is the complainant. Which is not to say, and so these are moments that are intensely discretionary moments of policing. And I would argue all policing is discretionary, even responses to instances of interpersonal violence. And we could see that today through the ways that domestic assaults and sexual assaults are policed or not policed, but these instances of vice and crime are particularly, you can see the politics of the police department at play very clearly because they're the only one enacting them. They're the only one who kind of sees the crime and defines it and creates that moment. And so LaGuardia says that that enforcing crimes of vice and morality is a very important priority of his police department, because he and Louis Valentine as well associated those crimes very closely with police corruption. In some cases, right, like that's accurate, but So what emerges from LaGuardia is this mode of policing where there's very intense surveillance around, justified through the enforcement of these crimes of vice, but that how those crimes are categorized, how police officers are directed to look for them and find them is very based on the identities of the people they're surveilling. And so this is these years, the early 20th century is a time when particularly the city's Black population is increasing really significantly. And LaGuardia has kind of a vision of racial liberalism in which he is opposed to racial discrimination on an individual level. And there were some instances where people would write to him, particularly in neighborhoods that were becoming more interracial or in white neighborhoods that were now abutting neighborhoods that were becoming more Black. People would write to him and complain often about Black children, like white parents would write and complain about interactions between their children and Black children. And he would write back in some instances and just say, you know, kids will be kids, like calm down. But he also, for the most part, and he did as well promote, he saw the value in promoting Black officials in limited capacities to positions in his government. But he didn't see the value in creating policies to actively impede or reduce discrimination or to kind of proactively create equality. And he also had these like cultural ideas about crime. So he thought that interracial and Black communities had more crime because of this kind of vision that he has. And so he has, because he has this perception of kind of racialized modes of crime, even though he's justifying police activity through ideas of equity, he believes that some areas are more criminal and so they deserve more police surveillance and more intense interactions with the police. And so throughout this period, you kind of have these arguments about equity at the same time as you have very intensely racialized and racist modes of policing and the way that they can kind of, that they interact together, I think is sort of the law and order liberalism of it. And his police commissioner is very supportive of and very instrumental in kind of crafting that vision, which also involves promoting Black members of the police department in very limited ways. And then kind of talking about how the police department is open to Black members at the same time as they are have the numbers of members of Black NYPD officers who are actually join the NYPD is very low. And then for people who are in the police department, they experience discrimination within the department as well. So, but because they have this perception that or this kind of awareness that the perception of equity is important, there are these kind of public statements of saying like, well, we do want more Black members of the NYPD. So anyway, all of that is to say that I think the way that policing is crafted under LaGuardia is a really significant break from how it operated before. And it is for him a very important part of putting that political vision into practice. And I think that political vision is still really influential in American urban politics and American liberal politics. And so that's part of why I wanted to explore it in the book.
Yeah, and it's really important. I think that many folks today would understand policing as important in politics, but they would be inclined to say, yeah, it's important to the politics of the right. Like if you wanted to say that, you know, like if you were just to reference law and order as sort of a piece of political rhetoric, most would probably immediately think of the right. And there's been some good work by historians that have pointed out the extent to which it's as much a part of the politics of the left as well. Like Elizabeth Hinton's work on LBJ is a prominent example that of course comes to mind. And so you mentioned law and order liberalism, that term, a few times in the last answer that you gave. But it's obviously a really important and sort of foundational part of what the book is arguing. And so I'm wondering if you could just like succinctly give us a definition of what your vision of what law and order liberalism is exactly. And then also, why do we have this misconception about law and order being tied just to conservatism, right? And how does this work help us to sort of better understand its relationship to all of American politics, not just a particular portion of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would describe law and order liberalism as sort of what the idea that I was just explaining. So the idea that that people deserve kind of an equitable relationship to the state, but that the effects of the state's entities on different branches of the populace can be dramatically different based on social identities of race and class and gender. So I think the kind of key and nationality and you know, many other kind of vectors of difference. But so I think the key kind of core element is this this kind of conception of equity with a disparate and often violent result that is not uniform across the population.
Awesome.
And as far as the why do we have this like common association between law and order and the right? That was the second question, right?
Yeah, and sort of how this helps us understand that, how does history troubles that conception?
Yeah, I mean, I think look, part of the reason why we have that association is because in contemporary political discourse, the right sort of proactively takes up that mantle more explicitly. And I think, you know, when we write histories, we can't help but write them from the present. And so our experiences of the present do inform the questions we ask about the past and how we understand them. And so I think, you know, initially when people were thinking about crime and policing and mass incarceration, you know, you do think about the hard right and the arguments in support of state violence and racist policing and kind of explore those, which have an important history. But I also think there is this kind of other element to it, which is sort of like, why has so little changed? I mean, this is kind of a common thread throughout historiographies of policing. Like historians are always thinking about change over time. And there are some historians who are sort of like the history of policing in America is really one of racist violence and continuity and resistance. And so I think that looking at the histories of Democratic, which I wouldn't always necessarily associate with left, but the way that Democratic political figures have embraced these policies, you know, rhetoric also, but the policies and practices themselves as well, helps us understand why it is so hard to make change and why these policies seem quite intractable in a lot of ways. And what I feel like I saw in researching this book is that the very model of policing that we live with now and that is extremely normalized now and that I think people kind of think of as always being there, but is quite new, less than 100 years old. This model of a nonpartisan, professional, multi-gender, mixed race police department that's charged with intense surveillance of racialized communities, of youth, and of working class people to some extent in some areas as well, that dates to this period. This is when that emerges, and that is, it's very new, or it's relatively recent, and it is that since the model of policing we're familiar with has been in existence, it has been flawed in many of the ways that we're familiar with today. And if we were to sort of look through recent American history to try to find a moment when policing was better, which is not to say that it hasn't changed over time, and that there haven't been significant alterations, but I think if we were to look through time and try to find a moment, you know, the 1930s were a moment when the state was expanding and producing a lot of really essential and really incredible social services in a way that we have not seen really since then. And it was a moment of massive expansion in public infrastructure, you know, so many of like pools, parks, what, you know, all of these built environment around New York City that the public still uses, a lot of it dates back to this period. So, you know, this is a moment when in a lot of ways, public life was becoming more inclusive, more expansive, and better for people. And so if there was kind of a moment when policing would have been better, it could have been, you know, you think that maybe it would have been this moment. But what we see instead is that while these other parts of the state are expanding, so too is expanding this mode of surveillance and criminalization and punitive exclusions. And it becomes part of the way that certain people are kind of carved out of acceptable public life. So it's kind of like there are these new new parks, and we want, and this is another part of LaGuardia's politics, where it's like regular New Yorkers deserve to have a vibrant, full public life. And that shouldn't be impeded on by these criminals or crooks or delinquents. Those people should be driven out because they worsen life for the regular non-criminals. And the way that those people are described and created, what kind of what gets put into those buckets, is very racialized, very gendered, and very class-based. And that, to some extent, that language still motivates the way that Democratic mayors talk about crime today by saying that, like, while working class, you know, like in New York, Eric Adams will say, you know, Black outer borough communities want more police. That's why they deserve, you know, a heavier police presence. And that's part of the responsibilities of government, is to create safety for those people. And then, you know, members of those communities are the same people who are criminalized. And what I saw in the research for my book, which a lot of other historians have also argued, like particularly LaShawn Harris, is that when you look at heavily policed Black communities, there's never kind of one political orientation. There are some property owners and store owners and landlords who are saying, we want more police, we want a heavier police presence. Some of those people are then themselves still victims of police brutality and violence. And then there are other people in those communities who are saying, we don't want a heavier police presence. We are being attacked, we're being criminalized, our children are being beaten on the subways. We want other things. And even the people who are saying we want a heavier police presence, we're always also saying that in concert with, we want better schools, we want equitable funding for all of our neighborhood public services, we want parks, we want all of these things. And the only way that the state really responded for the most part was with more police.
So I was saving this question for a little bit later, but that segue is so good that I'll jump to it now. And then we'll come back to the next thing I was going to ask about was how gender's impacting policing. But I'm going to circle back to that. And of course, that may be a part of the answer here as well. But you have this 1942 survey that you talk about in a few different spots. And you talk about some responses to it, like 2% of Black residents said they would go to police if they couldn't get their rights, right? A really low percentage. 34 to 45% stated that the country should be more concerned with establishing democracy at home instead of defeating enemies abroad. And I'm bringing some of those data points in because a lot of our popular discourse and some scholarship make pretty sweeping claims about like what the quote unquote Black community wants vis-a-vis policing. which is problematic for a lot of the reasons that you just said, right? It's not it's opinion is not homogenous, right? But you have this chapter on policing nightlife in Harlem and resistance to that policing that I think is a really good case study, if you will, on the relationship between predominantly Black urban spaces and neighborhoods and the way they're interacting with police, and at times calling for more police protection, at times resisting the presence of police in ways that really complicate that relationship, that speaks to not only the history, but how we talk about policing and race today. So that's all sort of a lead up to asking you if you could talk a little bit more about that chapter on Harlem, and what some of the big takeaways are for us in both the history and how we're talking about policing.
Harlem was one of the neighborhoods in the city that was most criminalized during this period. And it was both because it was the city's most prominent Black neighborhood, but also because it was a center for nightlife, which was connected to its identity as a Black neighborhood because of the kind of racist history of the interconnections between leisure scapes and race and in the years before the time period that I write about. But so the discourse from particularly Louis Valentine, the police commissioner, is very like, Harlem is so dangerous. Even my own police officers are not safe there. We need a really heavy police presence there. And the way that Harlem residents responded to that police presence, as you're saying, varied. It was diverse across different members of the community, and also ran throughout my different chapters. So, you know, for example, there was a big concern for a lot of Harlem parents was the ways that their children were victimized by police violence and brutality, because that was quite common for Black children in this time period. So in some instances, just kind of harassment, and in other instances, like really disturbing and vicious assaults. But so one of the ways that I sort of, how I chose to organize the way that I was discussing that in the book was to focus partly on the criminalization of the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem. And part of the reason why I wanted to focus on that is because, so the time period that I wrote about in the book, LaGuardia's administration, is basically bookended by two moments of mass uprising in Harlem against, partly motivated by racist and violent policing. And so there's one in 1935 and one in 1943 that people are pretty familiar with. And I wanted to look at the kind of day-to-day policing that produced those moments of mass protest and uprising, and not just look at the kind of exceptional moment itself, but the sort of regular experiences that predated it. And these dynamics around the Savoy Ballroom ended up being very illustrative of a lot of the kind of themes that I was looking at in the book. And so this was one of the city's most well-known nightclubs. And it was also one of the only spaces where there was kind of regular and accepted interracial socializing in the city during this period, because nightlife was still intensely racially segregated. And because of that, it was under frequent surveillance by the NYPD throughout the 1930s. And it ultimately is closed down during the war because there are accusations that enlisted men are meeting sex workers there and contracting venereal diseases. And in the subsequent hearings to try to get it reopened, the managers and owners talk about how the NYPD has been trying to close them down for years, and how they've actually been trying to steer white sailors and soldiers away from the nightclub so that the police presence will be less intense, illustrating that they know that it's the interracial mixing that is driving the police surveillance and the police presence. And so it's under surveillance throughout the 1930s, illustrating that, you know, the concerns that kind of become most intense during the war are present previously. And there's also, interestingly, the mayor and his commissioner of licenses, Paul Moss, had also been trying to close down burlesque theaters throughout the city in the 1930s and actually were taken to court and lost because it was an infringement on civil liberties. And then during the war, they're able to win because they're saying that soldiers and sailors are going to these burlesque clubs and their morals are impaired. And so the Savoy is targeted as this interracial space of interracial socializing and nightlife. And there was intense surveillance at the nightclub throughout the war years. And one of the dynamics that I saw and where I found some of my sources was through health department records, where men who thought they had sexually transmitted infections would go to health clinics for treatment, and they would then be interrogated about where about the what they called the source of their infection, meaning who they think they contracted their sexually transmitted infection from. And then they would give some sort of name or description, and the health department would then share that with the NYPD to follow up on. But the way that men were sort of, both enlisted men and kind of civilians, were educated to think about venereal diseases during this period was informed by these racist and sexist ideas of contagion and disease. And so there was also this kind of idea that sexually transmitted infections basically went from women to men. So in a lot of these reports, they would name women that they met at the Savoy. And actually the manager of the Savoy later said that he thought they would just name it because that was a place that the NYPD knew of. And so it was like an easy place to sort of say, that's where I met somebody. So there's this body of sources that like points to the Savoy, and that is informed, I think, by these larger racist and sexist ideas about contagion and disease. And then that then becomes justification for the surveillance. And then once you have that intense surveillance, then, you know, eventually they're going to find something that is going to work for them. So eventually, one of the surveilling officers sees an interaction and describes it as seeing somebody getting picked up by sex workers. The Savoy is closed down. And then there is this mass campaign from Black Harlem residents to reopen the Savoy, but also to accurately describe the role that it played in Harlem and the reason why it was closed down and why it was so intensely surveilled. And so one of my favorite characters in my book is the novelist Anne Petrie, who during this time had not yet written her first famous novel, The Street, and was a reporter for the left-wing Black newspaper, The People's Voice, that was started by Adam Clayton Powell Jr. And so she, during this time, she writes an open letter to LaGuardia saying the Savoy nightclub played it was a community meeting space. It played a really important role in the Harlem neighborhoods and in the community. And I mean, she didn't, you know, the letter is more succinct than this, but it was the biggest kind of open space in the community. And so a lot of fundraisers would be held there, which is really important for a community that is denied equitable funding by the city and in which, there is less concentrated wealth than in white communities. So the fundraising is important, and it played a very an important social role in the community. So she talks about that role. She talks about LaGuardia's response to the closing of the Savoy, which was basically just to kind of throw up his hands and say, well, I can't really do anything about it. And she, in a really smart way in this letter, says, well, you're doing something about all of these other problems in the city. You're such an engaged and hands-on mayor. And yet with this thing, you say you can't do anything. And is that because the Savoy is in a Black community. And then she also talks about the way that Black women, that the justification for closing the Savoy is based on this racist idea of Black women as sex workers and venereal disease carriers. And the letter is accompanied by a picture of Black women volunteers holding some kind of charity event, Black women volunteers in the army. But they're, you know, dressed up very properly in their outfits and to show kind of, you know, there's this idea that Black women are not contributing to the war effort and are in fact undermining it through these criminal and kind of disease carrying ways, but actually look, kind of here is the accurate depiction. And she says something like, we picked this image from, you know, there are hundreds of images like it that we could have used. And that illustrates another theme that kind of runs throughout some of the activism, which is Black women saying, we refuse to be labeled in this racist way as sex workers, as venereal disease carriers. We are contributing to the war effort. We are kind of, we're not going to be categorized in that way, essentially. And so that becomes a key part of the campaign against the Savoy, but it's not successful. I mean, the Savoy is closed down for a lot longer than a lot of other nightclubs that were closed during that same period. Ultimately, it does reopen. But then when it reopens, the managers say, we're going to be much more aggressive about preventing enlisted men from coming in and talking to women. We're going to try to kind of incorporate some of the city's policing practices into more aggressively into the way that we run the nightclub in order to kind of assuage the NYPD's intense focus on them. So that is kind of one illustrative dynamic. I also look at the way that racist policing plays out in other parts of the city. And so another area that was a really interesting illustration of the kind of wartime dynamics for me was what happened on the northeastern tip of Staten Island, where there was a number of Black soldiers were sent to this army facility there. And it was a predominantly white neighborhood that they were sent into. And the district attorney there starts complaining to the press and to the mayor and saying that there's a crime wave that's being started by the Black soldiers who are working at this army facility. And it becomes this kind of big story. The district attorney is essentially trying to use it to build up his own political reputation. But a number of Black soldiers are arrested. It kind of provokes violence and hostility from the white residents who live in the area around it. And it leads to this dynamic that was very surprising and interesting to me, in which there are undercover investigators from the Army, the National NAACP, and the a committee that the mayor creates because he's concerned about racial unrest, not as much about racism and lack of civil rights, but about the potential for conflict over that, called the Mayor's Committee on Unity. And so each of those groups sends an undercover investigator to sort of circulate in this area and ask people questions about like what's going on there. And the city's Black newspapers from Harlem and from Brooklyn send investigators or send journalists there to cover the story, because it's this clear illustration of the way that even Black enlisted men are targeted as criminals and as supposedly undermining the war effort. By threatening white residents, even while they are doing their job in the military. And you have these white Staten Island representatives in city council who are saying, we are contributing to the war effort. Our families are you know, are living in this area around the Army facility. And while, you know, while our men are at war, our families are being victimized and put in peril by these Black criminals. And so it's like these civilian residents are trying to mobilize. They're kind of right-wing political representatives, to be fair, are trying to mobilize this rhetoric of wartime participation and citizenship in an exclusively white way against the Black soldiers who are stationed there, who then, when they were talking to Black newspapers, talked about feeling like prisoners of war because they were so intensely surveilled by the NYPD when they left Army facilities and then also patrolled by a military police on the when they were in the Army facility. So that was another way that some of those racial politics are playing out during this period.
So one of the other ways that the politics of the wartime politics play out is along gender lines in a really profound way that comes out in the book. The policing of women, and especially the policing of women sex workers, has long been seen as a threat to society, et cetera, especially by police, and it's motivated a lot of policing. But that gets intensified in a particular kind of way in the wartime context, it seems, in this book. And so you have this chapter on policing sex workers, and then you also, it sort of juxtaposes with this other chapter on policing mostly male gamblers and male soldiers in ways that there's differences in along racial lines, et cetera, there also. So I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit more, because we've talked about it, but we haven't highlighted it enough, I don't think, is how gender shapes these different modes of policing and the politics of policing during wartime.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that underlies all of that is just the sort of simple fact that men were drafted into the war, into the military, and women were not. And that was illustrative of this idea that male labor, both in the armed forces and in production at home, was the kind of central social resource that was fueling the war effort. And women's labor was peripheral. It could contribute and it could support. And of course, then this is not to say that women, you know, weren't in the armed services. They were, but they weren't conceived of as foundational in the same way. And so that kind of foundational division undergirds a lot of the way that policing is mobilized during the war. And so for the male gamblers, you have this like, it's intensely racialized as well. Within those kind of that branching off of those two different sectors. But so for men, the kind of when I was looking at the way that, and part of the reason why I wrote that chapter about gambling is because I wanted to I was interested in women's experiences, but I also wanted to think about how gender and citizenship informed men's experiences as well in the way that policing happened for men, because men have gender too. And what was interesting to me in that, in looking at the way that gamblers were policed, is that it was totally, for white men, it was totally bifurcated based on if you were in the military or not. And so like there, you know, once there is a curfew established, the directive to the NYPD is if you find enlisted men in a place after curfew, send them home. And if you find civilian men, you can take them in. And so because the idea is, and part of the justification actually for policing gamblers is we have to protect enlisted men who are serving, who are contributing to the war effort from being preyed upon by these predatory gamblers. And so the idea is like they want to preserve the resources of enlisted men. They don't want to arrest them. And then, you know, they're spending how many days in jail and then going before a court, et cetera. Like they want to avoid that because their labor is important and significant. But because Black men are so intensely criminalized, even if they're in the military, they are still targeted and, you know, and assaulted in the case of the Harlem uprising. Somebody, you know, in uniform is attacked by the police. And as I just described, you know, there's this whole episode where men serving in the military in Staten Island are criminalized just for being there, essentially. And they actually talk about how they are treated worse than the Italian prisoners of war that they're serving alongside. So for men, that kind of there's this kind of racialized and bifurcated idea, but the underlying ethos is that resource, that human resource, is an essential part of the war effort. Whereas for women, they are much more framed as a potential sexual threat who could undermine the war effort by either impairing the morality of enlisted men or by giving them sexually transmitted infections. I anti-prostitution policing and anti-juvenile delinquency policing was already a big priority for LaGuardia and Valentine in the 1930s. And LaGuardia is somebody who supports the wartime measures to intensify policing of prostitution. He testifies in favor of the May Act, which made sex work near a military installation a federal crime. And he actually argues that the law should be stronger and harsher. So that was already a priority for them. But during the war, again, it becomes this issue of national security, and there is new federal attention and federal support thrown at the supposed problem. And what is interesting, one element of this that was really interesting to me was that women who were arrested for sex work, or girls who were, there's kind of a lot of crossover with the sexual policing of adult women and of girls and young women who were juveniles. And in either case, women and girls could be forcibly tested for venereal diseases, whether they were convicted of sex work or not. So just prior to conviction, just the accusation was enough. But what is really interesting is that I found all these letters from the doctors who were doing those testing, talking about how they didn't know how to read these tests, the laboratory tests on women's bodies, and saying you're looking for discharge, but it's really hard to know what kind and what is. And they talk about how in 94 instances, 94% of roughly something like that, 94% of the cases where women were then judged to have sexually transmitted infections and forcibly sent to one of the city's public hospitals for venereal disease treatment, which is what happened if they couldn't prove that they could pay for their own treatment at home. And then they would have to stay there for a period of months to undergo this kind of prolonged and painful and ineffective treatment. But in a vast majority of the cases where women were sent to those hospitals, they were sent after a laboratory test that was read as negative, but the social factors that were also taken into account, predominantly meaning their arrest in a lot of instances, not whether or not they were convicted, then meant that they were deemed to be infectious. And so it's interesting to see that moment of kind of the way that doctors themselves are also part of this social construction of disease, which is interesting to be writing about at the same time as, you know, we were all living through the COVID pandemic and kind of thinking about how to understand those modes of infection and disease as well.
Great. Well, I think that we've probably taken up a lot of your time, and that's a pretty good place to end. So a final question that we always like to ask is, what are you working on now that you might like to share with us?
That's a great question. I will say I'm still working on promoting this book. And, you know, as somebody who has a young kid, like taking a little bit of a break. But I am starting to think about my next project, and I'm thinking I continue to be interested in women's lives and experiences in relation to the carceral state. And there are a few women in this story who kind of have stayed with me since I finished writing it. And I'm thinking about exploring the possibility of doing a kind of dual biography between women in different positions of the carceral state and sort of how they're interacting with each other and with these modes of punitive power.
Well, that sounds like a fantastic project and certainly a well-deserved break after this excellent book as well. So thank you. And we'll look forward to seeing that down the road. So thank you again for joining us. Again, Emily Brooks's new book is Gotham's War Within a War, Policing and the Birth of Law and Order Liberalism in World War II era New York City. And it is out now with University of North Carolina Press. Dr. Brooks, thank you so much for being with us on New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Jeff.